observations wherever you may be. We've got Scott and Kirk with us. And fellas, we're going to begin again with the story of the letter, the explanation. Really, it's not a story, but the exchange. A fellow that we've nicknamed Moody Jeff. Moody because he was a graduate of the Moody Bible Institute, a Bible theology major, a youth pastor for, I don't know, it was 5 years or 10 years, but for a good period of time was a youth pastor. His father was a pastor. And he wrote a letter with which started off reasonably good, you know, explaining kind of the journey that he had taken. It's a journey that many of us have been on, except we typically don't brag about our biblical education. We're really embarrassed by it. We're glad it. We're, you know, it's a weird situation.
Learn and, from it,
yeah. It's like Moshe when Yahweh asked him to go and retrieve his people from Egypt. Moshe was embarrassed by the fact that, you know, he had been in Egypt and really didn't have any interest to go because he was embarrassed. But yet he had to know that Yahweh chose him because he had experience in Egypt, and so he was a more effective spokesperson. You know, he spoke the language, he knew where to go. It was just much easier to work with somebody that has some working knowledge of what he's going to be up against. Yeah, sure. Can God supply everything? Yeah, but that's not God's style. You know, God could do everything on his own. It's just not his style. So he likes to for us to engage, for us to figure things out for ourselves, for us to be full participants, because that makes it a lot more enjoyable. And that's the prime objective anyway, is to engage in productive and purposeful relationship with humankind. So we are, I can speak for myself, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but while I'm embarrassed of many of the things that I said and did as a Christian, because I was an ordained ruling elder and taught evangelism and led Bible studies, and I'm really embarrassed with the things that I said and did. It was horrible that I was so deceived and that I was a deceiver there for a good period of time. Now that I've engaged in writing Prophet of Doom and Tea with Terrorists and Questioning Paul and yada yada and Intro to God, now Observations, I don't think that I would have been successful doing those things had it not been for my experience as a Christian, because you understand the mindset of the beast. But so, you know, it's we're embarrassed. And yet we realize, you know, it's really an advantage. For example, you know, when I was writing Questioning Paul, the thing that helped me the most in writing Questioning Paul was having written Prophet of Doom.
Yeah, and that's amazing.
Yeah, having come to study the Quran, having been one of the first to put the Quran in chronological order and set it into the context of Muhammad's life using the Hadith, and coming to know that Allah was a manifestation of Satan and how Satan never wants to be known as Satan. But he wants to be known as if he were God, Allah. And so you really become vastly more effective with those kind of experiences, understanding. So we all have a we all look at our past, I think, that way. But you know, Moody Jeff was kind of bragging about his scholarship. And you know, it doesn't strike us well, but that's how he began his letter. And we are now on page 11 of 18 in terms of the exchange between the two of us. And he was criticizing my reluctance to, in fact, not my, he was criticizing my propensity to be critical of English words that are used to replace Yahweh's terminology. Really critical of that. And the example he was using was gospel, which he misrepresented and said, you know, since Christians think it means good news, you know, what's wrong with using it? Well, because it miscommunicates the actual statement that God makes. Now, God does not have a gospel. It creates the impression that God has a gospel. He doesn't have a gospel. it creates the impression that God's name is God, and that he casts spells. He doesn't do those things, and that's not his name.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, when it was spoken in Hebrew, it would have been tob, which means beneficial, healing, pleasurable, desirable, good, useful, productive, tob. Tob is the word that Yahweh uses to qualify his Torah. He says his Torah is tob. All of those things. And then he would have said tob malak. You know, in Hebrew, it's the adjective follows the noun, so it would be malak tob. But in English, we would say it the other way around. And malak is the Hebrew word for messenger. Lots of Hebrew words for message, as in communicating a statement. There's probably 20 Hebrew words for communicating a statement in words. Malak is not the Hebrew word for message. The Hebrew word for messenger, and that's how it would have been used. And the Greek word for messenger is agelos. You means good in Greek. So you angelos would be, in Greek, good messenger.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hebrew, it is good, beneficial, productive, pleasing messenger. So to say good news is to miss all of that, because Yahusha was a messenger. He served to communicate the message of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And you miss all of that when you corrupt the term. So there is a consequence. So he says, you know, you don't make a very good case for condemning Christianity. Well, how about just taking the word Christianity? That's how we ended our last observation show.
Mm-hmm.
The word Christianity does not appear in God's nomenclature. He does not have a word Christian. God has no religion named Christianity.
No. He has nobody named Christ.
He has no one named Christ, and he most certainly doesn't have anything akin to Christianity. Now, the two places where Christianity is presented are presented by an individual that God himself did not choose. God did not know Luke, did not speak to Luke. Luke was not an eyewitness to any of these things, and he wrote this in a personal letter that is now known as the Book of Acts. The Book of Acts is not scripture. It was not inspired by God. It was written by a man who served as Paul's liaison for a number of years. And he speaks of there came a time where the people were first called, and the Greek word that he wrote was not Christian.
No. Christian.
No. It was, yes, it was rather than being based on the Greek Christos, it was Christus, and an E rather than an I, and then a U versus an O. And in Greek, there are very distinct letters to communicate these sounds. The word was written with two letters that caused the word to mean something entirely different. Now, you have to be really careful, and that English is the same way. You change one letter in a word, much less two, and you have an entirely different word.
Right.
The Christus, for Christianios, was a word that spoke of those that were properly prepared to serve.
Right. To do the work.
To do the work. Yeah, it's a working term, and it spoke of being properly prepared to work and to serve in a particular function, and that not only were you properly prepared, but that you were an appropriate choice to engage in that work.
Mm-hmm.
It did not mean, it was not based on Christos, which is the Greek verb for the applying drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Christos means to drug in
is
Greek.
That ironic?
Right. Yeah, it's really ironic. And so you got a religion that's based upon a bogus term. And the reason is that you won't find Christos, Christou or Christon, written out on a single manuscript prior to the time of Constantine. In fact, you almost have to go all the way to Theodosius before you're going to see it written out. And when it's finally written out, because it's always placeholders, because he was not the Christ. His last name wasn't Christ. No one ever referred to him as Christ. They referred to him as Yosha. And when they wanted to apply a title to him, it was Messiah, not Messiah, and most certainly not Christ or Christos. And so the first time that it's written out in the Texas, the Codex Vaticanus, and Sinaiticus, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's not in all three.
Yeah, it might even be in each of them.
And, I look it up as one.
Yeah. And what you find is that's the first time that someone attempted to replace the placeholder with a Greek word. And the Greek word that it's replaced with is written Christus, not Christos. And yet, ignoring that, they chose the term for drugged. And so when you talk about condemning Christianity, well, that's one of the problems, is that you're using a term that not only has no basis in the Greek, it has no basis in the Hebrew, it has no basis, no identification at all with God, and the term that is used is a corruption, in fact, a complete counterfeit of the original term that was written in Greek, which was spoken, would have been spoken in Hebrew, and written by a person who was not even an eyewitness. It's hearsay.
Why does that bother some people, and it doesn't bother so many?
Yeah, you're right.
That disturbed me immensely. I said, my gosh, every term I know is wrong.
Yeah, in fact, it is. Every term you know, the worst, of course, is church. And it's not just because church is named after a sun goddess of the Teutonic Germanic religion, church. It's not just that it has no basis whatsoever in the Greek and no basis in the spoken Hebrew. It's that it's a replacement for one of the most important terms in Hebrew, mikra.
Mm-hmm.
And so it replaces mikra and has the Christian Jesus Christ creating a church as opposed to fulfilling and building upon his mikra, which was the entire purpose he came. And so the corruption there is literally life and death.
Yeah, because they'll quote you as those friends of yours did, those people working on your house. I built my church on the rock. I mean, come on.
Yeah, he didn't. Not only didn't he speak English, he didn't speak church, and he didn't speak. He didn't say the name of a pagan sun goddess. But what he said was that he would bana build. Hebrew is bana, which means build the family name. It's actually the feminine of Ben, which is the Hebrew word for son. I will build my mikra. These are the set-apart meetings that Yahweh has established to provide the means for us to transition from being stuck in our three-dimensional world and enter his seven-dimensional presence. Extraordinarily important. Seven successive meetings that take us from here to there. And that's what he spoke about. And yet, Christians think he established a church. And it's absolutely obvious that he didn't. And all it takes is an open mind, just a modicum of study. You'll come to the Greek text and you'll read Ecclesia. And then you need to think for a moment, because you've got to have an open mind and be rational and say, wait a minute. First of all, what does ecclesia mean? Ek means out, and ecclesia means to call. So it means to call out. Okay, then the next thing you have to realize is that is not church. You can't transliterate a church. You can't translate it as church. So you have been lied to when it comes to church. And now you ought to be angry, because if they lied to you about that, what else did they lie to you about?
Mm-hmm.
Because they call everything church, and they refer to their Jesus Christ having a church and a church of God, and yet there is no such thing. You have been lied to about the core of your religion by those in your religion. Now, that ought to upset you. But then what you ought to think about is, well, did he speak Greek? And the answer is hell no. So what language was he speaking? Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
So what word is there in Hebrew that can be transliterated, ecclesia, to call out, recognizing it was central to his mission, and that it was spoken immediately before he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bekodim, and Shavua. What word is tied to the fulfillment of Passover? Unyeasted bread, firstborn children, and the promise of seven. That means to call out.
Well, kara is called out. Mikra is the
right.
Call out meaning. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The verb would be kara, and the verb forms the basis of the noun. He was speaking of a noun. It's translated as a noun, ecclesia. So it has to be mikra.
Right.
And if you realize that he was establishing his mikra, there is nothing more important to know. That's what he came to do. Then you need to view him through that lens, that there are seven invitations to be called out and to meet with God, and that Yoshe himself observed them, fulfilled them, honored them, attended them, became the living embodiment of them. And so if you claim to follow him, to care anything about him, you ought to as well.
Yeah, and that would make you Torah observant.
And that would mean that you couldn't be a Christian anymore.
That's right.
It really, so when you get to the meaning of words and the corruption of words, you get right to the core of the evidence for the case to condemn Christianity. But Moody Jeff missed that entirely.
Yeah.
Then he says, but although I will agree with you that without Paul, there is no Christianity. Well, it's true that without Paul, there is no Christianity. That's just flat out statement of fact. Yosha came and said, first thing he said in the Sermon on the Mount, don't think I came to annul or to replace or to do away with the Torah. Don't think for a moment that I did that. And so there is no, and he never used a term even remotely akin to Christianity or church or a new covenant. And so you got no chance through Yosha. And so Christianity is the product of Paul. Okay, so what?
Yeah.
That's not the important point. It's not that without Paul there is no Christianity. The important point is that Paul's letters are a wholesale and unmitigated attack on Yahweh's testimony, his Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Yeah, diametrically opposed.
Right.
You cannot get any more far
correct
opposite than what Yosha said.
Correct. He is the antithesis of what the disciples said. He is the antithesis of what Yosha said. What he wrote is the antithesis of what Yahweh said. Therefore, it is Paul versus everyone else. If you look at all the prophets, you look at the Torah, you look at all of the writings, whether it be from Moshe or Dod or Yashaya, Isaiah, doesn't matter. You take the entire scope of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, what Paul wrote is the absolute antithesis of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. And when you realize...
Hold on to nothing.
Right. And then once you realize that half of the Christian New Testament is not only not inspired by God, but was inspired by someone whose life mission it was to undermine and contradict God, then you have to say, wait a minute, now even the book they tell me is the Word of God is full of it. It's rubbish.
Yeah.
It's counter to God. Right. Now if they lied to you about that, why would you identify with this religion? What is it that they told you is true? The Trinity is not true.
No.
Christmas and Easter aren't true. Sunday worship is not true. Church is not true. Christianity is not true. Christ is not true. Jesus is not true.
When they call him in history books, the followers, the disciples, they call him, and the people around him, the inner circle, when they call him the followers of the way, what way were they following?
Yes. Yahweh only has one way.
New way.
Right. Yahweh only has one way.
Yeah. Same path.
Yeah, same path. The path goes through. There's only one path presented. It happens to be that same path that is depicted through the Mikra.
Uh-huh.
It's a seven-step path to God. Right. Seven-step path to God.
Taking your sheep from pasture to pasture to pasture to pasture.
Yeah. It's what Zion actually represents. The Hebrew word Zion means signpost along the way.
Way.
And, of course, the way, Zion, is coterminous with Moriah, which is where Abraham and then Yosha fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bekodim. and it surrounds even Shibuya. It's where, you know, he's going to return. It's where he's going to build his home when he returns. So he says, you know, although I will agree with you that without Paul, there is no Christianity, that's it's missing the point altogether. Then he says, speaking of the Gospels, he puts now in quotes, that is all you have when it comes to the life of Yosha.
Not so.
And yet you condemn the sources so completely. Absolutely false. I mean, why do you think that the Torah and prophets exist? What do you think is in them? You know, if you read the eyewitness accounts, and the only two eyewitness accounts that we have are the one by Yahu Kanan, who says almost nothing about what happened prior to the fulfillment of Pesach, yeah. He takes it from that point on. Although he talks about the one meeting, he talks about it, the one with Nicodemus, where they emphasize the importance of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Matanyah, of course, there you go through and you have a reasonable presentation of Yosha's life and important public statements, including the Sermon on the Mount, which completely destroys Christianity. I mean, it just right out of the bat, no chance for it. But not one of these either of these two accounts, or the other only other credible book would be Revelation, also dictated to Yahu Kanan. They don't explain what happened on Matzah.
Mm-mm.
They don't.
No.
And so,
if they did, the Christians would have a problem.
Oh, destroy Christianity. Yeah.
They ignore it completely.
Yeah. Now, they may have, and it just may have been removed, but the fact of the matter is there's nothing there. If you want to actually understand what happened on Pesach, want to understand the Roman flagellums that were ripped the skin off his back and how that transpired, the results of it. If you want to understand the upright pole that became the upright pillar of Passover.
Mm-hmm. Stood up for us.
Right. If you want to understand what transpired so that he would have to say, my God, why have you forsaken me? If you want to know what happened then to his body, which was destroyed, if you want to know then what happened to his soul on Matzah, on the Shabbat, if you then want to know how the events of Bukurim, firstborn children, transpired, you have to read Psalm 22, written by Dode. Mizmor, Psalm 88, also written by Dode David. 1,000 years before these events took place. The best eyewitness accounts are those two, followed by Yeshaya 53, Isaiah 53. Those are the three best eyewitness presentations of what happened. And if you want to understand the context of those 3 days and the fourth day that would follow some seven sevens later of Shabua, you have to read the heart of the Torah, Kara, which is corrupted to Leviticus. That's where all of this is presented.
That's a crime, too.
Yes. So that's where it's all presented, and it's by far the most detailed and precise presentation of precisely what happened at that time. So if you want to read an eyewitness accounts of the events, it's not in Matthew. It's not in Yahu Kanan John, Matanyahu or Yahu Kanan. It's written by Dode David. 1,000 years beforehand, or by Yeshaya 777 years beforehand.
Well, 22 even describes both the science and the medical terms in which he died.
Yes, yeah, it describes, died. Yeah.
You know that then.
Yeah, in fact, the depiction of the mode of death for the Passover lamb in Mizmor 22, Psalm 22, presents scientific reality of that process way, how many thousands of years, almost 3,000 years before it was understood?
Yeah.
How you drowned in your own fluids?
Mm-hmm.
how you get to be thirsty and yet you're drowning in your own fluids, how your heart stops, loses its strength, how your bones are stretched out of their sockets and yet your bones are not broken. The whole presentation is vividly presented in medical terms and by the ultimate eyewitness. And Dode was an eyewitness 1,000 years before the events because, allowed him to see it. And then go back into his time and to write about it. And so, rather than the Gospels being all there is when it comes to the life of Yosha, you only have one that talks about his life, and that's Matanyah. And what it has to say about his life is wholly and completely adverse to Christianity. And in reality, by far the best accounts are written in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. This is a Christian perspective that is just wrong. And when people write this kind of stuff, and they stated as fact, he wasn't asking a question here. He says, but speaking of the Gospels, all you have, it's all you have when it comes to the life of Yosha.
And it's more of an accusation.
And then you condemn them so completely. That's not a question, that's a statement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's entirely wrong. And by the way, I don't condemn them completely. That also is wrong. I see you have to be really careful with Luke because, A, Luke was associated with Paul, and Paul is the plague of death from God's perspective. And he was not an eyewitness, so what he wrote is hearsay. So you have to be really careful with that. Mark wasn't there either.
No.
He didn't witness any of this. We don't even know for certain his affiliation with anybody, although it's assumed that maybe, although there's no proof of this, that maybe he was a translator for
Shimon Kefesh,
misnamed Peter. Yeah. But we don't have any proof of that. That's kind of the legacy sort of thing. But Shimon Kefesh didn't write it. And so that's not eyewitness either. So you have another problem. And then you Yahu Kanan didn't speak much about his life. He spoke most about what happened after Bakurim and the conversations that occurred after Bakurim. So they're insights, but they're not biography.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I say, Matanyah is wholly contrary to Christianity, so Christians actually have to throw it out. They don't consider it. They can't, because it's so hostile to the religion. And then you've got this other problem, which is that there are more errors, more contradictions, more discrepancies, variations, and there are actually words.
Yeah.
That the,
about 1.5 times or 2 times.
Almost 300,000 known discrepancies, variations between the oldest manuscripts and those that now form the basis of English translations. 300,000, only 182,000 words.
They have a historical value in that someone reported that these things that were going to happen, whoever prophesized to happen on a specific time, you can place these events at that time. Beyond that, you have to dig real deep.
So. Yeah, but if you want to place the timing of the events, all you got to do is read Daniel. Daniel tells you the precise day.
Right, the dash day.
And what was year 4,000, 33 CE in our pagan calendars, 4 days before Pesach, and exact observance of the Torah's presentation of Pesach, the Passover lamb, came into the heart of the land, into Jerusalem, 4 days before Passover. It would have been a branch Monday. And it tells you then what happened on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of that week. And so you don't actually need anything that's in the Christian New Testament, although I will admit that there's a lot in Matanyah that is that affirms what we have come to read and helps us understand really what was predicted in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
But it does beg the question that if those things were so important to Yahweh, he would preserve some somewhere, and he didn't.
He didn't. And he would have made it available to us.
He had a lot of interest in it either.
Right. Yeah, in fact, yeah, it was very clear that the people he chose to convey his message to the world are Yehudim, Israelites. Mm-hmm. You know, Mark and Luke were not Yehudim.
No, they're Greek.
Yeah, they were Greek and Roman.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're not Yehudim.
Of course, no.
Right, yeah, primarily Greek. And so, and 100% of Yahweh's language of revelation is Hebrew. So you don't have anything that dates back to the first century CE written in Hebrew that is even remotely reliable, unlike the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, where the Dead Sea Scrolls prove that they are there's fewer than one word in 14 that are changed, and the ability we have now through the Dead Sea Scrolls is to recover most of that, and also because God tells us what his presentation so many different ways in so many different places, it's extraordinarily easy to get to better than 99% complete in terms of an accurate with what he had to convey in Hebrew. You can't even get to 5% accurate in the Greek because of the quality of the manuscripts and the fact that it's already a translation of what was spoken. So God clearly didn't intend for us to have it, because we don't have it. that's just the fact. And you know, right? Yeah. And if you want to take the approach of you know, you condemn the sources so completely, you know, I would go to Yahweh Bereth or Bless Yahweh, either one of those two websites, and you can open the 9th chapter of Observations, and you can read about a 20-page analysis of the history of Christian Bible translations. And if by the time you're finished reading that, you haven't completely trashed your New Testament and said, oh, my God, there's nothing in here that maybe there's some of Matthew, although we've misnamed it, and a little of Yao Kanan and Revelation that have some value. But apart from that, this doesn't even approach being viable.
You really want to hang your eternal hat on that?
Oh, yeah, it's... It needs to be condemned because it isn't trustworthy.
Yes.
That's just it's not that I condemn it. It's just the facts condemn it. The evidence condemns it. And it to not condemn it is to either be ignorant or irrational of the facts. Take some time and study this for yourself. You know, the fact that you can't believe that God will allow his testimony to be corrupted, screams that you've got two problems. One is that you don't realize that the Christian New Testament ain't his testimony. It isn't his word. And number two, you understand the concept of free will. That God had not only allowed it, and one of the first compelling stories in the Torah is about him allowing Satan to do this very thing. And so he not only allowed it, he had to allow it for the very existence of free will. So there you are, and so when somebody writes this kind of stuff, it really upsets me, because it just shows that they've got this, their whole perspective and their attitude is wrong. And this is an ad hominem attack.
Yes, because he's not talking to you. If you
right,
were perpetrated,
right, 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 you condemn, you condemn it completely. And yet, you know, this is all we know, and yet you condemn it. You're the one that's wrong, because we know from this.
Know.
No, you don't know from that. And don't condemn me. Look at the facts. And if you're going to make an argument based on the facts. Don't make your premise a lie. And the premise here is a lie. And it's not just a meaningless lie. It's a lie that goes right to the heart of God's testimony. God gave us everything we need to know who he is and what he's offering and what he expects from us. And when you discount that to say that, no, it's you don't know anything about Yosha from that. Well, let me tell you something, pal. You wouldn't even know Yosha's name if it wasn't for that.
Yeah. He came in his father's name. Was his father's name Zeus?
No, 222 times.
Yeah.
You find Yosha's name written in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Mm-hmm. And it appears first with the revelation of the Torah. You know how many times you find it in the Christian New Testament? Zero.
Zero. What, doesn't that scare you?
Wow. Oh, by the way, yeah, you've been lied to about the existence of a Jesus. If they've lied to you about the guy they claim is the founder of your religion, and they haven't got a clue what his name was or what his name means,
yeah.
Why would you trust him?
And they tell you there's power in the name of Jesus.
There ain't none.
Who are you kidding?
Yeah, it's just
complete. These things to me, as you know.
Exactly.
Especially when I first, 10 years ago, I mean, it's like, wow.
Yeah, how many times have I been lied to about just the core of my religion, you know?
And you didn't even introduce me to the guy.
Yeah, and if you don't know about what Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkota mean, then you're left with you're left with this Pauline stupidity of God dying. God can't die. He did not die.
No.
But yet that's all you're left with. If you don't know the story, if you don't read the story from beginning to end. So then he says, and this is just astounding what he says next. If you are using your interpretation of what Yahusha did during his time here, from your interpretations of the Torah and prophets and Psalms, then you are engaging in circular reasoning. Oh my God. I mean, this guy... You just want to. I'm not a violent person. In fact, I never advocate violence. But metaphorically, you want to strangle him. You want to slap him across the face metaphorically, not physically.
No.
Punch him in the nose metaphorically. In fact, in a way, that's what you want to do. And then you realize, no, I don't want any part of this person. That's the last person I want to wake up. I know our good friend Frank is communicating with him and trying to help him. And I've made it really clear. I'm not going to help you. I don't want this guy as part of the covenant family. I don't want to spend eternity with him. I don't like him. Listen. Yahweh told his story in a straightforward manner. No circular reasoning. He said that he is the creator of the universe. He began at the beginning with the first word that he used to speak the universe into its existence. And he goes through the story of creation, through the story of the creation of humankind with the Nesalma, this ability to reason, the relationship that existed in the Garden of Eden, which is the entire purpose of why he created us. Just from there, all you need to know about God is presented. And then he goes through and he talks about how Satan corrupted his testimony to mislead, and from there goes into Babel, the English word, the Hebrew word that forms the term Bible, which means to intermix and to confuse. And then he tells the story of the flood and precisely what happened, when it happened, very scientific terms. It's a stunning story. And it's the story of the covenant. It says the one thing about Noah is he listened to what God said. It didn't argue with God, didn't say, hey, you know, that's your plan. I've got a different plan. Okay, you've got your old instructions here. You know, we got some new technology here for shipbuilding. I'm going to apply mine. No, he listened to God. God gave him the instructions of what to do. He acted upon them, did what God instructed him to do, and he and his family were spared. It's the story of the covenant. It's exactly how we participate in the covenant. And then he goes on to tell what is the most amazing story ever told, most important story ever told about his relationship with Abraham and how he and Abraham, Yahweh and Abraham, created the covenant. The terms and conditions of the covenant, which are five, the benefits of the covenant, which are five, told through this story in the seven meetings between Yahweh and Abraham. And he then, through that story, actually introduces us to Yahusha. He introduces us to the role Yahusha will play as the Passover lamb. He tells us exactly where he's going to fulfill that mission on Mount Moriah. Mm-hmm. Tells him, describes him as the Passover lamb. And it's exactly 40 Yobel, 2,000 years to the day that Yahusha would be standing there.
That's the best reporting you'll ever see, you'll ever read.
Best report. So to interpret Yosha's life through the words that Yahweh provided to give us perspective on his life so that we would understand his life isn't circular reasoning. That's reading the story from the beginning to the end. That's changing your perspective to God's perspective. I figure that his perspective on this has got to be pretty good. It's his story. I mean, rather than being circular reasoning, it's informed. It's the perspective from that's based in chronology. It's the story, it's the perspective that Yahweh himself, who is God, provides. And to suggest that is circular reasoning is reprehensible. Now, is it true, Kirk, that God doesn't say, all right, I'm going to have this fellow's going to be born. His name's going to be Yosha. And that he's going to come in year 4,000, yeah. And after telling us that he's going to fulfill my my Torah, he then is going to be the living embodiment of Passover, exact same place as Abraham did it, exactly 40 Yobel. By the way, 40 is the number of a completion of a time of testing, and Yobel is the time where all debts are forgiven and all slaves are freed. And that that in 40 Yobel from that time, on the exact same place, he's going to fulfill Pesach on an upright pole, which is the same term Edom that I use throughout my presentation, not only to speak of Passover and the upright poles of the doorway to life, but also the pillar that that is used for the tent of the witness. And he's going to do that, and the next day his soul is going to go into Sheol, and while it is in Sheol, he's going to redeem us at that point, and then he's going to see the light and become the firstborn child of Bukhurim. Does he say it in just matter of fact, just to lay it out like that?
Found, but all that is not written that way.
And that is correct.
There's a reason I can think of why, but but no, it's not only for the journey, for the but also because you know if you're not interested, you won't come.
Right. So all of the information needed to form those conclusions is provided. Correct. And it's told from many different perspectives over a long period of time through many of the writers of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's all there, and it's all consistent, and it's all affirmed, and easy, so long as you're willing to dig through it and put the pieces together.
Yeah, you have to have the want to.
You got to have the want to, and you got to have the open mind. The want to. Both in investing the time and the attitude, right? The right attitude. The
letters, attitude.
Right. Right. Attitude, perspective, and the want to. Got to have it. But if you do, you can come to those conclusions. Now, it is true that God didn't lay it out that simply.
Yes.
And there's a reason he didn't lay it out that simply. He wants you to make the connections so that you can figure it out. Because there's a difference between me telling you how to fish and you fishing. You know, if I wanted to go out and catch a marlin off the Kona coast, I would be a lot better off with a skipper and first mate that are experts in fishing because they've done a lot of fishing than I would be renting a boat improperly designed for the task and reading an article online.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God wants to engage with us, and he knows that if we participate in the process of learning and understanding, then we're going to be much more enjoyable partners as we spend and companions as we spend eternity together.
So let me speak to that a minute on a personal note because of what I'd mentioned to you that I was studying. I'm not going to launch into that, but I will tell you this. Brad sent me a chart. About the Exodus, I started to say, okay, well, let's see if we can figure out historically when it happened.
And is this the Brad that I went to high school with?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah, and, remarkable guy, isn't it? How lives come back around. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what kind of launched it for me.
Okay.
And then I went through this four or five things and proved with historical.
Now, can we just interrupt you 1 second here?
Oh, sure.
Brad is the living embodiment of what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Brad and I went to the same church together. Same high school, same church. We were both Christians together. Mm-hmm. We both left Christianity. We both came to know Yahweh. Brad has done what we have all done, grown in this through understanding. He's done his own thinking, his own searching, and he's come to some conclusions that we've all missed, and he's right. And we've all come to conclusions that others have missed. It is part of the voyage of discovery that makes it so much fun, and Brad's a living embodiment of that. So he sent you a chart that had some insights, and you decided, well, I'm going to pursue this, see what's up with this.
It took me in a totally different I got pretty much where I wanted to go, but it also mm-hmm. took me, I had to go dig up some old books that I'd read in high school and college, mm-hmm. and it also, here was what happened. I found a correlation between, say, Exodus with Egyptian papyrus, with stuff I found in the that you can find in the Leningrad Hermitage,
uh-huh.
and also in some other papyrus, plus more, but those were the biggies. And what it tells in the story, it goes verbatim through the Exodus that Moses drew the people out. It tells the history, it tells the events that are going on, both in some of these things even happen worldwide because of the catastrophes and so forth. And then there's an extraordinary thing that trying to figure out, what I did is I was trying to figure out, well, who invaded Egypt after Moshe?
Mm-hmm.
Give us a fix on the date. And there's so much bad history in Egyptology.
Rather is.
Pretty tricky. I mean, you got
One of the problems of Egyptian history is there is a lot of circular reasoning there. The biggest problem with the Egyptian history mm-hmm. is that the hieroglyphs that are inside of the, because almost everything that's known about Egyptian history is in religious shrines or in the pharaoh's tombs, and that's really all we know. And so the pharaohs were all trying to present themselves as God and trying to embellish their lives. And so they all lived longer and did more than they really did. And so they're like today's politicians. I mean, it's 5% believable, 95% hype. And so if you just take their lives as they presented them, then, Egyptian history lasted about five times longer than it really did. So you have to know where you prune, what you believe, what is credible, and you put together a timeline that actually shrinks Egyptian history to a reasonable time. And when you do that, you end up kind of with what David Rawl did. And it's he wrote a book that speaks specifically about the timelines and how the story of the Exodus fits into and the enslavement fits into a corrected version of the timeline. The problem is that in a lot of scholarship, like, for example, on man-made global warming, you either toe the line academically
or you're
discredited and probably fired. Egyptology, the same thing. You want to be part of the club and be a professor and to write on the subject. You have to toe the line and go along with what has been stated previously, or you're exercised from the community. Okay, so with those things said, go ahead.
Let me give you a teaser.
Okay.
On what I found, and then one day, if you want to, we can go somewhere.
Okay.
This
sure.
Kind of blew me away. Everyone wants it to be the Hyksos or something, but Moshe, after all these terrible catastrophes, Egyptian mm-hmm. Urn, they take them out. Moshe takes them out, the slaves.
Uh-huh.
And it's recorded by lots of people. I mean, it's not just in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And as they move out, they encounter a people called the Amalekites. The Amalekites mm-hmm. are not the Hyksos, and they are the Amalekites, and they are a tribe from from Arabia, what we call Saudi Arabia now, of nomads and really killers.
Mm-hmm.
And they raid, and you find we have this war or this battle when Hur and Aaron hold up Moshe's hands and so forth. So this is recorded. They're always fighting. Seems like they're always fighting the Amalekites from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got it in Psalms, we've got it in this, and Yahweh, this explained a couple things to me. It explained who invaded Egypt afterwards and filled the void, and the reason they were able to fill the void was because there was no army there to stop them.
Right.
They destroyed all the temples and things. Right. There's the characteristics of the Amalekites, which are freaky,
right.
especially because he wrote the Prophet of Doom.
Right.
Now,
yeah, Egypt went into serious decline.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't, by the way, this was, yeah, this yeah. this is not during the times of Ramses.
There is no
reference to Ramses in the Torah. There's the reference to a city named Ramses, but it's because Ramses meant son of Ra. Ra was the sun god. And so it was just a city that was named after the Egyptian sun god. But it wasn't the Pharaoh Ramses. That is, it's not in the Torah. That's not what God said, and that he was not the Torah, the Pharaoh of either Moshe's time or of the Exodus.
Mm-hmm. The teaser becomes Amalek, which where the Amalekites are named after. He's the grandson of Esau. And here's the characteristics of them that should trigger something in you. They're nomads that use camels from Arabia.
Uh-huh.
Thieves.
Uh-huh.
Brothers,
uh-huh.
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 Stories of culture, buildings, writings, temples, property.
Uh-huh.
They worship all the same sun and moon gods.
Uh-huh.
Babylon, et cetera, and all of that area.
Mm-hmm.
And Yahweh says to...
Is Islam. The Quran.
Really?
Yeah, Islam, the Quran, Muhammad.
When they dug up some of their sites, they found jaw bones and arms cut off, thrown and buried just separately.
Yeah, smite them on their necks. Cut off their heads. Islam, Muhammad again.
So I'm studying all this from ancient sources, long mm-hmm. before Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to me, the thing that was most interesting, when you go to Psalms and 78 and on and on and on and on, Yahweh keeps telling these people, with every encounter of these Amalekites,
mm-hmm.
he says, and especially when Yahshua goes into Israel and fights them there, he says, you have to kill these people. You have to destroy
right.
them. It's not
right.
just a dirty rat.
Right.
Equation. He says yeah. you've got to wipe them out.
And by the way, he did not say that you have to wipe them out in Arabia.
No.
He didn't say that you had to wipe them out.
They crossed over into the
right.
The
didn't say you had to wipe them out in Egypt or in Syria or any place. No, it's just this is my home. Yisrael is my home,
mm-hmm.
and this is a deadly, toxic disease.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't rid my home of this disease and understand why you can never have this disease present in my home without it killing everybody.
Yeah.
You need to understand that. And so I could wipe them out myself. I'm not going to. I'm going to give you instructions to wipe them out so that you understand how serious this is. Don't ever let this plague into my home. What is the plague? The plague is Islam today. The plague is religion.
Oh, yeah, and he tells them not only that. He says, not only that, I want to blot out the name of Amalekite.
Right.
And I don't want it spoken again. I don't want it heard again. And he tells them, there's another one I don't have right in front of me, but I think it's in Exodus also, or maybe Genesis, he says.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget this. Do this.
Right.
And it's like a warning. These people will still be here. And it's funny to me that all through even today,
uh-huh.
he mimics then exactly the same people doing exactly the same things, fighting his people in Israel,
mm-hmm.
Right down to the T. I mean, it's a little more involved than what I'm giving you, just a little overview. But
yeah.
He said, oh, I know what it is. It was in what has been miscalled. It's in Dabarim, 25:19, what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells them, don't be oblivious to this. Do this, and don't forget, and remember what I told you about this.
Right.
And if I was talking to...
because they are prophetic of today's Muslims who infect Israel.
Esau, too.
Right. Yeah, right from...
The same lineage, I don't know.
Right, right,
the same
of course.
But they claim the same mm-hmm. lineage, which is interesting enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that the Jews to this day call people Amalekites, that are evil.
Yeah.
In fact, Dr. Jeff and I were talking the other day, and he said he was telling me that too. And I said, "Isn't that interesting?" And here's a little.
But how many people have done what you've done? And we need to go back over this because it is so timely for our world. But how many people have taken the time to do the study as to what were the nature of these people? Yeah, and what's interesting, is that initially Yahweh didn't wipe them out. He Abraham and his family cohabitated the land with him, and then after the 400 years of slavery in Egypt and the Exodus, the time to wipe them out had come because their iniquity was complete. They were so rotten, so toxic, so inhospitable to life, so contrary to Yahweh's instructions and purpose and Torah, that the only safe way for their children to enter the land was for that toxin to be removed. It's just why you would never go to a house and bring your family into it, including your young children, if it was filled with vipers.
Yeah.
You wouldn't bring them into it if it had rats that were infected with the bubonic plague. You wouldn't do that because it would be deadly to them. Well, that's exactly what the Amalekites represent. And then they are, because you've done the history, they are exactly the same. Their religion is the same as the most satanic religion that exists today, Islam.
Right. Interesting. Here's a little sidebar. In 1898, I think it was, Kaiser Wilhelm, you know who he was, the Kaiser of Germany, he visits Israel. And he talks with the imams, or the Grand Mufti, or whoever he was then.
Yeah, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem.
He's saying in the records, in the German records, he says, you know, we are descendants of the Amalekites.
Oh, great.
He identified with them.
The Nazi Germans.
And that became,
well, with the pre-Nazi Germans. But
by Hitler, and they became, right. But it's not the same thought process that led to the to Hitler.
Yeah.
The Jews. You know, and to him, that was just, you know, proud of it.
Proud of it.
Whether they were or not is irrelevant. They totally adopted it.
Yeah, because of course they were not eradicated. Asked his children to eradicate them, and they were not eradicated.
No, Samuel said to Saul, "Go wipe them out again." Then eventually David had to deal with them, and then somebody else after that, you know. And finally, all the way down to Hezekiah is probably about the last of any consequence of them that we see that are actually called Amalekites.
Mm-hmm.
But they never go away. This evilness, this hate of Israel, this hate of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Is so inbred, and these people, they just, it's the same enemy.
It is the same enemy. Yeah, what is the primary enemy of Islam? Jews.
Yeah.
And why is that the case? Because it's satanic, and the Jews are Yahweh's chosen messengers.
Yeah.
They're his chosen people. They're his chosen people.
They chose them to give the message. They don't like the message.
They don't like the message. They don't like the messengers. They don't like the. They don't like the.
No.
Yeah, and you know, it's not that Muslims have this longing for Israel or for this mythical place called Palestine. No, it's their hatred of the Jews. They want to wipe them out.
Yeah, they want to destroy the place. They want to herald it.
Right. You know, the Temple Mount is a blight on Islam's credibility because Muhammad claimed in the Quran that he flew a winged ass from Mecca while he was having pedophilic relations with a 12-year-old, and he was 56 at the time, to have meetings in the temple, too stupid to know that it had been destroyed 700 years earlier, 600 years earlier. And so it is a complete disgrace to Islam. And of course, when the winged ass jumped up from the temple mount, the first stop along the way was hell. And so hell was up. And, you know, he tells a story that hell was filled with women who were hung by their breasts by meat hooks. And so the whole story is this incredibly condemning of Islam. And yet the temple, the Dome of the Rock is there as a triumph over Jews. Only reason it exists.